Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai 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 Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So we're continuing with Canto 8, Chapter 20, Text 13, and the chapter is entitled Bali Maharaj Surrenders the Universe. So we'll chant the text. Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignashati Adyashaha Katva Manam Hare Jude Saita Nihato Maya Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignashati Adyashaha Katva Manam Hare Jude Saita Nihato Maya Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignasati Adyashaha Katva Manam Hare Jude Saita Nihato Maya Please chant. Saitanya Tomaya Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignashati Adyashaha Atva Manam Yare Jude Shaita Nihato Maya Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignasati Adyashaha Katva Manam Hare Jude Saita Nihato Maya Eshava Uttama Shloko Na Jignasati Adyashaha Atva Manam Hare Jude Saitani Atomaya Maya Eshava Utamashloko. Najignasati Adyasha. Katvamana Marejude. Saitani Hatomaya. Okay, the word for word. Eshaha. This brahmachari. Va. Either. Uttama shlokaha. Is Lord Vishnu, who is worshipped by Vedic prayers. Na. Not. Jignasat. Desires to give up. Yat. Because. Yashaha. Perpetual fame. Hatva. After killing. Ma. Me. Enam. What is that? All this land. Haret. Will take away. Yude. In the fight. Saita will lie down. Nihataha, being killed. Maya, by me. So the translation and purport for text 13 by Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. If this Brahmana really is Lord Vishnu, who is worshipped by Vedic hymns, he would never give up his widespread reputation. Either he would lie down having been killed by me, or he would kill me in a fight. Purport. Bali Maharaj's statement that Vishnu would lie down having been killed is not the direct meaning. For Vishnu cannot be killed by anyone. Lord Vishnu can kill everyone, but he cannot be killed. Thus, the real meaning of the words lie down is that Lord Vishnu would reside within the core of Bali Maharaj's heart. Lord Vishnu is defeated by a devotee through devotional service. Otherwise, no one can defeat Lord Vishnu. Om Agyana Timarandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Rama Padaswami Iti Namine. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschitya Deshatarine. Vanchakalpa Tarubhya Vasundubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavinebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita, Garadhar, Shivasadi, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We've come to a point where, just looking back a little bit, Bali Maharaj has emphasized that he will give in charity whatever Lord Vamanadev asks of him. just by virtue of the fact that Vamanadev is a Brahmana. He's given specific reasons for his desire to do so. One reason is that it's very rare that one gets an opportunity to give one's accumulated wealth to a saintly person. And a saintly person, I mean, the importance of that, or why it's got a lot of weight, is that a saintly person is a worthy recipient of charity or such a gift. Because he creates holy places. The second reason for his desire to give to a Brahmana is that by giving such a gift of charity, a benevolent and merciful person, so he's putting himself in that position, becomes even more auspicious. So these are the two reasons for Bali Maharaj being quite willing to give in charity to Vamanadev. Now Bali Maharaj is addressing the fact that this Brahmana may be Lord Vishnu. So that's coming up in this verse. It came up yesterday. And earlier on, Sukracharya had even stated it. He said, and these were Sukracharya's words, this person falsely appearing as a brahmachari is actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari, who has come in this form to take away all your land, wealth, beauty, power, fame, and education. After taking away everything from you, he will deliver it to Indra, your enemy. So that was in the 19th chapter. And in this verse, Bali Maharaj is responding. If this Brahmana really is Lord Vishnu, who's worshipped by Vedic hymns, he would never give up his widespread reputation. Either he would lie down having been killed by me, or he would kill me in a fight. Bali Maharaj has indicated his own reputation. It came up a little bit earlier on, because he stated one should try to achieve a good reputation instead of anything else. So it's very important to him, reputation. And in his case, he wanted to uphold his own good reputation by keeping his promise that he would give the land to the Brahmana. And he'd even raised a very important question related to this topic of reputation or maintaining reputation. He said, I'm the grandson of Maharaj Prahlad Maharaj. How can I withdraw my promise because of greed for money when I've already said that I'll give this land? How can I behave like an ordinary cheater, especially towards a Brahmana? So Bali Maharaj is very, very conscious of reputation. And the reputation of Lord Vishnu, as seen by the demons, later on we'll come to it. They have a certain concept of Lord Vishnu's reputation. And they see him as a cheater. So these are their words. Later on we'll come to the overall view that all the demons hold of Lord Vishnu as far as his reputation goes. This Vamana is certainly not a Brahmana, but the best of cheaters, Lord Vishnu. Assuming the form of a Brahmana, he has covered his own form, and thus he's working for the interests of the demigods. So this will come later on in the 21st chapter. Sukracharya had actually understood the identity of this brahmachari. As he put it to Bali Maharaj, O son of Virojana, this brahmachari in the form of a dwarf is directly the imperishable Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. Accepting Kashyapa Muni as his father and Aditi as his mother, he has now appeared in order to fulfill his interest, of the demigods. Bali Maharaj is addressing this point of the reputation of Vamanadev, and he acknowledges, just like Sukracharya had stated it, just like the demons stated, he acknowledges he has covered himself in the form of a Brahmana. But he puts it this way, although he is Lord Vishnu himself, out of fear he has covered himself in the form of a Brahmana to come to me begging. So he's acknowledging it, he's covered. Now, Sukracharya had understood that Vamanadeva was none other than the imperishable Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that he'd appeared to fulfill the interests of the demigods. So Sukracharya has it quite clear. Bali Maharaj acknowledges it. And Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain that what is Bali Maharaj's view of Vamanadeva? He views Lord Vamanadeva as lying down or residing within his heart. This is this purport in today's verse. So the fact that Lord Vishnu is seen by Bali Maharaj to be lying down is that he's defeated, but through devotional service. So that's the missing component. So, you know, he's not spelling it out to Sukracharya, but the lying down is a defeat through devotional service. And that same Lord Vishnu that Sukracharya understood to be imperishable is also understood to be invincible by Bali Maharaj. They have the same understanding. And this is borne out by the fact that, or the fact of the Lord's appearance. He'd originally appeared in the form of Narayan with all his weapons. That was a little while back. And then, in the presence of his father and mother, he'd assumed the form of Lord Vamanadeva, a brahmachari dwarf. And the simile is there that just as a theatrical actor may change dress to play a different part. So that was earlier on in the 18th chapter. So the imperishable aspect of the Lord is that he assumes many thousands and millions of forms. And I found whenever this, I was noticing this particularly, that whenever this point comes up that he assumes many millions of forms, Srila Prabhupada always quotes the Brahma Samhita verse 533, Advaita Achyutam Anadim Ananda Rupam Ajam Purana Purusham. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inconceivable by the Vedas, but is obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who's without a second, who's not subject to decay, is without a beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha, yet he is a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. So this point of being indestructible is indicated by this change of his form or his body. It's not material to be able to change it at will. And despite all these different transcendental forms, he's still the same Supreme Personality of Godhead. So hence that indestructible factor that's been pointed to by both Sukracharya and Bali Maharaj having the similar understanding, indestructible being invincible. Now, the one Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's eternally engaged in many, many transcendental forms in relationships with his unalloyed devotees, is something that comes from the Purusha Bodhini Upanishad. It specifically states that the one Supreme Personality of Godhead is eternally engaged in many, many transcendental forms in relationships with his unalloyed devotees. And Srila Prabhupada, he states that Lord Vishnu covered himself as Vamanadeva, a Brahmana Brahmachari, to conceal his real identity. So that he, as the Supreme Lord, could enjoy some humor between himself and his devotee. So it's borne out, just this one form that we're witnessing here, it's the statement coming from the Purusha Bodhini Upanishad is borne out. He's going to be enjoying some humor between himself and his unalloyed devotee, Bali Maharaj. And Bali Maharaj himself is, as a devotee, is depending on the will of the Lord. And the will he's depending upon is the supreme will of the super soul. This is something that's coming out in this purport of Srila Prabhupada's. Externally, Vamanadeva is indicating his will to Bali Maharaj. So he says what his will is. O King, controller of the entire universe, although you are very munificent and are able to give me as much land as I want, I do not want anything from you that is unnecessary. If a learned Brahmana takes charity from others according to, to his needs, he does not become entangled in sinful activities. So externally, he indicates what his will is, very precisely, clearly, according to the form he's appearing in. And this point of Srila Prabhupada had me reflecting a little bit. And in the reflection, what came up was Lord Krishna describes how this will of the Lord as super soul is one of the five factors of action. So, adhisthanam tata karta karanam cha pritagvidam vividas cha partag chesta daivam vanam panchanam. And that's from 1814 Bhagavad Gita. So, the translation, the place of action, the body, the performer, the various senses, the many different kinds of endeavor, and ultimately the super soul. These are the five factors of action. And because Bali Maharaj is acting in Krishna consciousness under the direction of super soul, whom he recognizes externally as Vamanadev, he knows that the action itself will not bind him. So he's hearing the will of super soul via Vamanadev externally, and he's recognized him as none other than Lord Vishnu. And he knows that any action that he performs, if it's according to the will of super soul or Lord Vamanadev externally, is not going to bind him. And Srila Prabhupada puts it this way, those in complete Krishna consciousness are not ultimately responsible for their actions. Now, this is an interesting statement. Bali Maharaj, he shows this acceptance and dependence on the supreme will. I mean, it's indicated. meaning on the will of the super soul, Lord Vamanadev. He states, even if he irreligiously arrests me or even kills me, I shall not retaliate, even though he's my enemy. So he's dependent on the will of super soul, dependent on Lord Vamanadev's will. Whatever he's going to do, even if it's been going to be at the cost of his life, he accepts it. He's saying it. Now, the defeat is such that he'll be going along with the will of Lord Vishnu. So this is the defeat that he's indicating here. No, he's going to have to be killed. It's actually, his killing is accepting the will of Lord Vishnu rather than going with whatever may be, you know, that last remnant desire that we got some hint of back then, that he actually wants to enjoy the control of the universes, of the universe and the whole, all the planetary systems. now, according to the desires of Lord Vamanadev, he's becoming Bali Maharaj is becoming fully cognizant of the existence of Super Soul. And I found myself thinking of something that comes from an instruction. Who was it? Don't know if I made a note here. I'll just read it. It's from Srimad Bhagavatam 8.1.10. Within the universe, the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his super soul feature is present everywhere, wherever there is animate or inanimate beings. Therefore, one should accept only that which is allotted to him. One should not try to infringe upon the property of others. And this is the kind of turning point for Bali Maharaj. He's becoming cognizant that all the property of the universe is belonging to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whereas before he'd had that desire to conquer everything. It was sort of under his control. And now he's understanding that by accepting this principle, actually everything, Super Soul is present throughout all the universe. And actually everything's belonging to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So actually, Lord Vishnu, by accepting the will of Super Soul, the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that same Supreme Personality of Godhead and Super Soul will actually come to live in his heart. That's how he's putting it. So he's becoming purified of that desire to control the three worlds. So this is something of what I understood, and I think I'm slightly tired today because I'm noticing there's not like perfect, so forgive me. So these were some thoughts on this short purport. If there's any thoughts connected to this?
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. You. Maybe you just have a Nityananda festival hangover, which is a good thing. So that's probably why. Thank you for your class. This verse was mentioning that the Lord is defeated by bhakti. So in chapter 9, the Lord says, if one offers me a leaf, flower, fruit, water, I will accept it. Of course, he wouldn't accept Bali if he only gave a leaf. Here, you said give you a leaf, so you're satisfied. But my question is related to the point that we see that the Lord is grateful for, it doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are, how educated, because there's so many examples, like I wrote them down, like Rupa Goswami was considered a great scholar, and he knew many languages, but the Lord was also appreciative of the literate Brahmana, or Hanuman and the spider, Radharani's beauty, and Cujo, who was hunchback. He was appreciative of all the beauty, and in this pastime, of course, he was appreciative of the wealth of Bali Maharaj, but he was also appreciative of the wealth of the chip rice of Sudama Brahmana. So my question is related to the fact is that we hear in the Netta instructed that one should accept things that are favorable for bhakti, and anything that's not favorable should reject it. So the tendency is that sometimes, even though the Lord can appreciate your bhakti, or whatever aspect of your life, doesn't matter how significant you are, but sometimes devotees may not appreciate it, you know, because that's our conditioned nature. We appreciate people who are wealthy. I'm going to respect you. So how important is it? There's a dilemma that people may face is that, okay, I have my senior Vaishnavas, my Shisha Gurus, but if I take the instruction of everyone, I feel like maybe you're criticizing me based on, because you can't appreciate the aspect of the devotion. So that's the dilemma, is that I don't want to, I can't accept every instruction of every senior Vaishnava. And at the same time, you want to be honest, is that I appreciate your criticism, however constructive it may be, but, I'm respectful. I want to be honest. I don't want to just say I'll accept it and not accept it. So, but at the same time, I don't want to create Vaishnava pride. So how important is it to be honest and say, yes, I appreciate your opinion, but I have my shit, your gurus, my Diksha gurus that I'm following. And if I accept this instruction, it's kind of discouraging me, kind of. I feel, you know, disheartened. So I can't accept your instruction. I'm trying to maintain my bhakti, you know. So can you explain a little bit about that aspect, that dilemma we may face?
So Jai Baladev looked first at the point that Krishna is willing to accept a leaf, fruit, flower, or water, and so the important part being the bhakti component, and then he moved on from there to say that that same bhakti component could be very difficult for somebody to recognize in a devotee that perhaps didn't have the external trappings of wealth, because generally there's a tendency in society to look at the wealth or value the particular, I guess, attractive feature. He said could include education. So then this led him to come to the point that occasionally, taking that into account, occasionally somebody could come and give an instruction, and the difficulty that he found himself facing was, well, that instruction may not be in accord with other instructions coming from Shiksha Guru, etc. So he was wondering, taking into account that there's this problem of how he thinks he's being perceived, I'll say, and taking instruction where that perception he's believing is not in his favor, and at the same time not wanting to be offensive to the person because he knows that the instruction's not in accord with something he's received from Shiksha Guru. So, well, the one thing is that there's no doubt that wealth is an attractive feature. And in fact, it's the driving force for most persons in the material world. I mean, I'll give a personal example because it's close to home. I grew up in a home where the main emphasis of my parents was to accumulate wealth. That was the main emphasis. And indeed they did. So my father felt, you know, he'd achieved his goal in life because he'd accumulated tons of properties. So material, tangible, physical objects and land. So you know, whether that made them more attractive or not, I don't know. But certainly whenever he went to visit family members in a foreign country, he had to act in accord with his status of wealth. So hence, whoever was a family member would be the recipient of a gold coin. So this, you know, gave him a sense of satisfaction. You know, he actually had a certain status that allowed him to give gold coins, I presume. So now, the problem that you're expressing is that if one is not in that position where, you know, behind one is the, what would one say, the picture of wealth or the external trappings of wealth, and one is adopting the societal view that wealth is actually what makes one attractive or acceptable, then one's putting oneself immediately at a disadvantage. Not because one doesn't have the wealth, but because one believes that society is viewing one a particular way. So it's not necessarily that each and every member of society will be viewing one in a negative light because one doesn't have wealth, but rather one is putting oneself in that kind of disadvantaged position of thinking that, oh, now I'm not going to be viewed well because I don't have wealth. So then the question becomes, how does one actually shift that concept to a more positive concept of self-acceptance? So one does that by accepting the reality. The reality is that any wealth that anybody has accumulated is actually the property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And and that each and every individual has been allocated a certain portion of wealth in their lifetime according to the needs, the karma and the needs of the particular entity. So so one can put aside that concept of one doesn't have X amount, one has this amount. One just accepts this is the amount that's been allotted to me and embraces it. It's a reality, and it's a perfectly divine reality because it's been ordained by the Supreme Personality of Godhead that that is one's lot in life, and that's perfectly fine. So then when one has that kind of acceptance, oh, this is how much has been allocated to me, then one can look at the world more squarely in the face. Oh, all right. So now some devotee may be giving me an instruction. So one's not approaching the situation armed with concepts of self-defeat. One's rather approaching the situation, okay, I have this amount allocated to me. At the moment, I'm not at peace with the amount that's been allocated to me, but I accept this is how much has been allocated to me. I don't know how another person is viewing me, but if it's a devotee, no doubt the person's trying to look more at the soul aspect. So the person is looking more at that the soul that's jubilant, ecstatic in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that person is actually wishing to fan the spark of one's devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of all wealth. So in that particular case, the instruction that's coming, if one finds that it's not in accord with something one is following coming from one Shiksha's guru, there's no problem telling the person an instruction that I've received, if one wishes to share it, could be telling the person, this is the instruction I've received. So actually, what you're directing me is not quite in accord with that, but because perhaps I don't fully understand, I'll take what you've said and I'll share it with my Shiksha guru, because that's the source of my instruction. You let the person know, because then that prevents the discomfort of later on future instructions coming that, you know, one's already resistant to. So one can happily say it. No devotee is going to be disturbed by that. Because, well, it's certainly not. I mean, because it's not that you're saying, I reject, but you acknowledge where the source of the instructions are that coming for you that are important. I mean, it's your relationship for instruction. And that's a proper way. There has to be that one source where you take an instruction from. I mean, for to be able to actually meditate, execute properly, and it's a loving relationship, proper trust. I mean, that's a very precious thing. Any devotee would understand that. So the one communicates that and continues working internally for greater self-acceptance, not concerned with how one may possibly be viewed externally according to absence or excess presence of wealth, because that's truly not something that one should carry unnecessarily on one's shoulder. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. You had quoted Srila Prabhupada, that very interesting quote that I can phrase it, I don't know the exact words, that those completely absorbed in Krishna consciousness are ultimately not responsible for their actions. And also in Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 3, verse 27, Krishna says that those who are bewildered by the influence of false ego, so those not in Krishna consciousness, their actions are simply carried out by the three modes of material nature. So in either case, we are not responsible for our actions. So in that case, where is free will? If it's not existing in our actions, where is free will existing?
Okay, so this is a very interesting question. The statement by Srila Prabhupada on the one side is that the person who's fully Krishna conscious is ultimately not responsible for their action. And then on the other side, the point you've raised from 327 is that a person under the influence of false ego is thinking himself, you know, the cause of his action, but in actual fact, the action is being carried out by the three modes of material nature. So, what you're seeing there is that there isn't responsibility on the part of the person if the action is really being carried out by the three modes of material nature. So then you're wondering, where does free will fit into all of this? If on the one hand it appears that all the action is being carried out by the modes of material nature, and on the other side that really it's the Supreme Personality of God, it is who's in control of everything. Where's the free will factor? So the statement of Srila Prabhupada, I was making a connection with Bali Maharaj because he'd come, that last vestige of the enjoying spirit was actually being taken from his heart, which was what was allowing for Super Soul to be fully manifest there, and he was going to be carrying basically Lord Vamanadev in his heart. That was his surrendering to the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead was that he surrender his control and literally the land that he was controlling, the entire universe, to him. And the Bali Maharaj's acknowledgement of performing action according to the will of Super Soul, who is manifesting externally as Vamanadev, is what allowed for this kind of handing of responsibility over to Super Soul. He's acting in accord with Super Soul's direction, therefore Super Soul has responsibility for that action. But it required him to acquiesce to the will of Super Soul. So it was completely conscious and deliberate. So certainly there was very much free will in the picture there. He chose that path, even in this very hairy situation that it was opposed to the view of the personality that was giving him spiritual guidance. So he consciously used his will in a particular way. So, but the responsibility ultimately rests with the Supreme Personality of God for the action Bali Maharaj performs, because it's the will of the Supreme Personality of God. But it required Bali Maharaj to acquiesce to it. Now, on the other side, the particular verse from Bhagavad Gita that you're drawing from, where the living entity is, all the actions of the living entity are carried out by the three modes of material nature, or the living entity that's, you know, under sway of the false ego. So that living entity hasn't acknowledged the will of the Supreme Personality of God coming through instruction. That particular living entity is merely functioning with those five factors of action that I brought up, that from the 18th chapter, their particular senses, their perceptions, their body, which is being dictated by the modes of material nature. So they have very little control in the end, but where the free will comes in is their choice to acknowledge the presence of super soul or acknowledge the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So super soul is facilitating that entity is being put into certain situations where all the factors for action can go into play, but the person is not acknowledging. So that's a form of will too, to not acknowledge or choose not to. So one can say that unfortunately the person hasn't received education, hasn't heard the messages of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or hasn't heard instructions coming from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. So, you know, are they really choosing? There's choice involved. There is choice involved. Because any time that intelligence is used and a person looks around, the person has to start to see that there's repetitive patterns going on. The actions they're performing are of a certain kind, the results of a certain kind, and is not in their control. So that sort of reflection is necessary to have the person understand that they're making a free will choice to either not acquiesce to a higher living being that's actually in charge of everything, or else that they haven't acknowledged that such a being exists, and they're just going through a mindless functioning. So there's free will in both cases, actually.
So the picture I have painted in my mind is that the free will is on the platform of either accepting the instructions of Supersoul or not. In which case, if not, then one is subject to, like you said, the laws of nature. Whereas if one does, then Krishna is responsible because he's then dictating those actions. Is there a platform in which one's actions are colored by their own... is there any point where one's own, individuality, like, it's colored consciously by their own personal contribution to pleasing the Lord, like... That's the question. Yeah.
Okay. So the question is looking on the side of the, or rather the fundamental thing, the understanding from the response was that it's acquiescing to super soul that is the important component in the whole picture of free will. And then the question that followed was, does somebody, is there not like an individual flavor in that acquiescing part? Because if following the instructions of super soul then makes super soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, responsible for the action that the person performs, is there still not some individual part there that's sort of... colouring how things work out? Okay, freely. The instructions that come from Super Soul are completely individualized. There's not the generic one instruction. So the whole of Bhagavad Gita has Krishna giving instructions and they're to a specific devotee, and it requires the expertise of somebody who's the external representation of Super Soul then to tailor specific instructions that are specific to the individual. So hence the spiritual master comes into the picture as the external representation of Super Soul, who can actually tailor and give the individual flavor of instruction to the particular individual. So it certainly isn't generic at all. It's a little bit like if one goes to an Ayurvedic doctor and is seeking treatment. So, or let's say two persons go together and both persons have a very strong pitta constitution. Then one pitta person may be advised that they have to avoid being in the sun too much because their pitta is very high and it'll aggravate the pitta. But the other pitta person may be advised to actually spend more time in the sun because it'll actually be beneficial to them. So it's very much individualized, the instructions of Krishna, the Super Soul. And that individualized instruction or the individual flavor is given by the external representation of Super Soul, the spiritual master, who can actually tailor it according to the mind, the senses, the body, the karmic component of the particular individual, so that the instructions are harmonious for that individual and allow for the individual to flourish and become purified of desires and habits that create a block in that relationship with Super Soul.
So indeed, the instructions are quite individualized, which is, it's in line with that quote from, you mentioned of Upanishad, that that's one reason why the Lord takes on so many various forms. The question then, as before, was that the freedom that's exercised, though the instructions are individuals, that's adding color and uniqueness. But the color and uniqueness is at no point a contribution, because Krishna says he's fulfilling the desires of his devotees. Yet those desires are actually, they just eternally exist as Krishna desired them to exist. They're not colored by one's creation of a desire, or like that free will is not, it's not on that platform that I have a desire, even in the context of pleasing the Supreme Lord, but it's never one's own idea of how the Supreme Lord, somehow the Supreme Lord is even granting them that flavor by their own constitutional position, or
the point you've made that is seems to indicate that you're holding onto an idea that there isn't even individual desire, that even desire is created by the Supreme Personality of God. That's the idea that I'm understanding that you're expressing. well, that doesn't, and you specifically said that desire, even in the devotional realm, is created by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If one were to look at, you know, the two categories going back earlier on to the original question, in the category of the persons being controlled by false ego, the ideas that are being held there are, a lot of them are coming from impressions in the mind, through different lifetimes, and the particular senses that have been given, the particular body that's been given, the particular situation that's been created by Supersoul for the person to act out their particular desires that are coming from those impressions in the mind and the ideas connected to those impressions, the ideas they hold of themselves. It's something like Jai Baladev's question. One holds a certain idea of oneself or an idea of how the world views one. So in that particular scenario of being under the control of the modes of material nature, the desire is individual. It still is based on the individual acting, that the impressions are being made, that the future body is being created according to the individual's desires and acting them out. So, and then in the second scenario where the individual has turned to the instructions of Supersoul and is trying to act in accord with the will of Supersoul, in that particular scenario, one still could not say that Supersoul's creating the desires. Still, one would have to say that the individual has desires, and then because the individual's trying to act in accord with the Supersoul, the individual uses intelligence and looks to the intelligence of spiritual master or an elevated personality to try and channel the desire to be in line with the will of the Supreme Lord. So in both cases, the desire is individual. It's not created by Supersoul. It's not created by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's still individual. Sure. Oh, and yeah, then we can bring the microphone back for a response.
In Bhagavad Gita, 13:22, so it is mentioned that Purusha Prakriti Sthohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jan Gunas.
Hold the microphone closer.
Purusha Prakriti Sthohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jan Gunas Karanam Gunasangasya Sada Sad Juni Janvasu. So the translation is the living entity in material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of nature. This is due to his association with material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil among various species. So here that means how that Bhagavad Gita is stating, that Krishna is telling, he is aloof from all this. It is due to his karanam gunasangasya. Prabhupada used to always say karanam gunasangasya, because of association with material nature. Krishna is aloof from that. He is above that. That was what you told, that he doesn't detect, oh, you do all this, all that. No. Super Sahil, he is Namam Karmani Limpanti Gunam. That is again he's telling. I am aloof from that. I am not, there is no work on that aspect which binds me. So still, yeah, his question is free will. This is still present. Even if you go to Vrindavan, Golok Vrindavan, if you serve Krishna there also, free will is associated with you. So you cannot get, because we did some mistake are there in Golok Vrindavan, that's why we are here. We are suffering.
So thank even you, if you are Prabhu, for bringing up some supporting statements for the idea of the persons who fall in the first category that are under the control of false ego, that it's the modes of material nature acting and that Krishna is aloof. You added that part. Thank you very much.
So the idea that I have is that, or I'm holding on to, so to speak, is that In the material world, there's desire is colored by the three modes of material nature. And in the spiritual world, desire is colored by one's eternal constitutional position as servant of the Supreme Lord, whether that's maybe a cowherd boy or a cow, or so to speak. And then free will is existing on the platform of choosing one or the other. It's a yes or no platform.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, I mean, whereas, I mean, I guess the conditioning is that I'm creating my own identity in the material world. We tend to think that, but that's an illusion. It's just the three modes. Like, those actions that are creating some apparent identity is just some covering that's, you know, temporary and nonsense. And then in the spiritual world, that identity is, I guess the idea is that for me is that that identity is just, it is what it is. And that is, I mean, we eternally exist as that, which is, and it's, it's hard to...
Okay. I think what I'm understanding is you're looking a little at the question of identity or the concept one holds of oneself, and you're pointing to, yes, you're understanding that, and I'm constantly drawing back to your first question and the two categories. So the persons that are under the sway of ego, you're understanding that they're the concepts that are held, are flavored and colored by that interaction with the modes of material nature. So, you know, one starts to have certain experiences and then it becomes fixed in one's ego, that like whole body of concepts of oneself. Oh, okay, I've been told by teacher X, teacher Y, and teacher Z that I'm very proficient in learning. So now I walk around and I hold the concept, I'm very proficient at learning. I can approach the world having this concept of myself. So when I'm in a situation that requires learning, I've been told I'm proficient at learning. So I will now act according to the concept I'm holding within that ego framework. So that's all within the realm of with one's senses, with one's body, with one's mind, with the intelligence that's been granted to us, that's been constructed by material nature according to one's desires. So one got a certain, the desire preceded the creation of that body with those senses, that mind, that intelligence, that then... It's a yes, I want to be able to utilize good intelligence in this lifetime to be able to learn well. So certain body, certain senses, certain mind, certain intelligence is granted according to previous work one did, that one deserved to receive that. So there it is, one has that. One now has that concept. One's approaching the world with that, I'm a proficient learner. One's approaching the whole world with that concept. Not given, not fully. One already had that desire from a previous life to be able to utilize intelligence in a particular way. There were certain activities that were performed, and yes, generally the subtle body is carried from one lifetime to another, which means that the concepts one holds in this life, there were pretty similar concepts held in a previous life. You know, I guess some metamorphosis happens, but the subtle body is carried from lifetime to lifetime. So it means the desires reside in the mind, the desires are going along with the subtle body. It's not that you separate out the desires from the subtle body and then artificially the desires get put on the subtle body. The desires are driving the subtle body. No, material nature creates the... So that was covering that particular aspect of the flavor. So Sibal wanted to add something. So I may have come to a standstill since it's producing some head shaking. So Sibal, please make your contribution.
I think the point is well made already. And, you know, one thing that can add to what you say, in the spiritual world, we learn that from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. There are different, there's a variegatedness of different rasas that are there. And there are living entities, spirit souls, that are within these different rasas according to and the relationship that they have with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We all part and parcels, and every part and parcel have a particular rasa with the Lord. So that's there. Within that rasa, the living entity is fully satisfied. It's not that the servant is aspiring. It's the cowherd boy, is the idea of something else aside the cowherd boy is like, no, they're the cowherd boys. So there's the question of yes and no there. The yes and no for us is, like Krishna Archana pointed out very clearly, yes, I'm with Krishna, and not with Krishna. So that's in the spiritual world, it's not that, should I be a cowherd boy? Maybe I should be the cowherd girl, like that. It doesn't, there's no yes and no there in terms of what you're doing, and your desires are within, the rasa that you have, and that's an eternal rasa. Well, she answered it very clearly in so many ways, in terms that the desires that we experience here is just a product of all the interactions that we have with the false. It's a full identification, and then the desires are, fed towards that false identification, and then it becomes, a whole mess. In the spiritual world, our desires they go through our real identification, the actual identity of who we are. We are, a spirit soul that have an eternal relationship with Krishna, an eternal rasa. And there is variegatedness, like that verse that she quoted, that the Lord manifests to reciprocate with a particular rasa, to experience a mood. So Bhishma, his mood is to throw arrows at Krishna and wound him and cause pain in Krishna's so-called externally, he's wounding him and there's blood, as described. And Krishna's enjoying the whole thing, his offerings of flowers, like that. So there's all that variegatedness. So I think if there's more questions, maybe it can be, why don't you ask a question, but after, we think we should stop.
Jai Baladev has seen a contradiction.
Okay, Jai Baladev, you have to keep it. You cannot put the Baladev purport. Okay.
In the interest of...
I'm not going to go a half hour, but...
In the interest of individual desire,
we will
acquiesce to individual desire.
See, everyone has their perspective, but anyway, we'll get to that afterwards. But it's kind of related to the whole thing, not necessarily about who's right or who's wrong, but the aspect of just like Lord Chaitanya, when he was associated with Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami said, "I do not know anything." Ramananda Roy said, "I do not know anything." So when we ask questions and think we know the answer, how important is it for us? You know, because the most important things is we learn in the whole Gita, the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, is that Krishna is not looking for someone who knows the most, valedictorian. He's looking for someone who loves the most. Because what can we know? Krishna says, "I know past, present, and future." So even if we give an answer, that, you know, unless Krishna reveals it to us, we could just speculate all we want. Or so, you know, we may have all these things about free will, this and that, and we may think we're right or somebody else is right. But how important is that, or how irrelevant is that in the ultimate sense? The most important is our relationship with devotees. Oh, you have free will, I'm right, you're wrong, this and that. What can we know? We don't know anything. And that's the basis of my question, is that Rupa Goswami said, "I don't know anything." Ramananda Roy said, "I don't know anything." All the devotees said, "I don't know anything. But whatever I speak is according to the inspiration." So how important is it to be humble to when we speak? To, yes, I'm speaking according to my realization, but I'm not trying to defeat anyone.
The question's interesting. That how one approaches looking at a topic that one has questions about. So Jai Baladev, you were asking how big of a component is the mood of humbleness in examining a topic? And you were drawing on two examples of devotees of Lord Chaitanya who took the position of verbally stating, "I don't know." So it would indicate that you have an understanding already that having a humble approach is the mood by which some topic is explored. That's what I'm understanding. You already have that concept. So certainly, I think the difficulty we all face is that the concepts one's holding in the false ego that one is walking around with have been there for many lifetimes. I mean, some are very deeply entrenched. So if one's exploring a spiritual topic, sometimes one is hitting against those concepts in that whole body of ego, the false ego. It's very natural. It's very natural. And it's also a sign of good intelligence that one is looking at something, and even if the false ego is pushing its concepts, one is exploring it. So it's a sign of very good intelligence. But the point you've brought up is the one of having taken a position, actually, "I don't know," and that facilitates receiving knowledge, certainly spiritual knowledge. So in accord with that, it's certainly everything in line with the scriptures, because ultimately, and I think Jaini Tagore Hari brought this up, that ultimately we know that those concepts held in the false ego are things one wants to discard. We understand that. So, indeed, having taking the correct position of willingness to hear or explore, and perhaps even, you know, receive knowledge if it's coming from a trusted devotional source, is puts one well ahead in terms of being able to discard a big chunk of those concepts that are hampering one's moving forward in spiritual life. So thank you. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Forgive me for my slight tiredness today. Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.